Sounds like a good time. Welcome to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy. And it is another beautiful day, Friday, March 27th. It's 11 a.m. And today we have a pretty good show for you. NASA is launching a new study with twins. They're going to have one on Earth and one in the space station. And I'll give you more updates on that. After that, we're going to go into men and beards. Do growing beards show dominance? After that, we're going to go through a story about real-life robots versus the ones we see in Hollywood. This year, we're going to see several movies about artificial intelligence. And then after that, we'll do a story about Alcoholics Anonymous and how critics are faulting it for lack of empirical evidence, followed by Ford Motor Company. They have new sensors that can detect speed signs and adjust your car's speed to them. Then melting Antarctic sheet system. Right now, you've heard this probably your whole life, but the Antarctic's in trouble and the ice caps are melting. And there's more evidence, and we'll go over that. Later on, climate finance, promoting clean water. And then Neanderthals and how they went extinct. New evidence shows that not only people, but our first domesticated animal, dogs, might have helped usher in their demise. And then last but not least, the Large Hadron Collider and its search for parallel universes, which just happened earlier this week, here on Worldwise at radio.dominican.edu. So first up, do men grow beards to show dominance? Here's what science has to say about that. Scientists have long known that beards can make a man seem more dominant and masculine. Now, provocative new research involving primates shows that male facial hair is more elaborate in social groups involving intense competition for rank, dominance, and attractiveness. Is the same phenomena in humans, and could that explain things like the hipster beard? Well, maybe. In general, our new research shows that body ornaments appear to be more elaborate in larger groups of primates. That means, you know, a larger population. And the same may apply to humans, which live in fairly large societies. This is coming from Dr. Cyril Groutier, an associate professor of biological anthropology at the University of Western Australia in Perth. And he's the study's author. For the study, the researchers analyzed facial hair and other body ornaments of 154 primate species from the long capes of white and silvery hair in hominidrous baboons to the elongated noses of proboscis monkeys. The researchers found that the males of the species in complex social groups flaunted more conspicuous ornaments than the males of species in small groups. The findings suggest that flamboyant ornaments are of greater benefit to males in complex social groups, which are involved in greater competition. When you live in a small group where everyone knows everyone because of repeated interactions, there is no need to signal quality and competitiveness via ornaments, Grutier said in a written statement. In large groups where individuals are surrounded by strangers, we need a quick, reliable tool to evaluate someone's strength and quality, and that's where these elaborate ornaments come in. In the case of humans, this may also be included in phenotypic extensions such as body decoration, could it be like jewelry, tattoos, as well as prestige items like, you know, Gucci handbag. But looking back at beards, the researchers noted that mustaches and beards among British men became really popular between 1842 and 1971, and that's a period where there were more men competing in the marriage pool. So it's an interesting report. Moving on from that, we have a story about real-life artificial intelligence that we're making headways in, and their Hollywood rivals such as the Terminator. So artificial intelligence is going to be a pretty big deal in Hollywood in 2015. There's a lot of movies that are coming out, new robots from old friends like R2-D2 and C-3PO in the new Star Wars movie coming out, to the Avengers movies, which will feature Ultron, who's like a really big sentient robot, as well as the Terminator. Arnold Schwarzenegger is actually going to reprise his role in a new Terminator movie this year. So, autonomous vehicles aerial drones, they're pretty much now an integral part of life as we know it, especially in military operations. And that's coming from drone historian Richard Whittle, as reported by CNET. The next step, some predict, will be to create drones that employ AI to decide on their own when and whom to attack. Militaries around the world are already working on drones potentially capable of such autonomous strikes. Peter Acero, co-founder of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control, told Live Science that those weapons range from the U.S. Navy's X-47B, which can take off and land automatically from an aircraft carrier, to the supersonic British Taranis, which can automatically dodge missiles. The Israeli Harpy missile can identify and attack enemy radar installations on its own. So there's already a lot of things that work off of a thing called IFF, Identify Friend or Foe, and these systems are now becoming more and more autonomous. After predicting the appearance of self-deciding military drones back in 2006 in his book Mind Wars, Jonathan Moreno said that he's seen an escalation in the military's interest in neuroscience and AI. There's lots of conversation on the use of neuroscience for machines that use weapons, Moreno, a professor of neuroethics at the University of Pennsylvania, says. In the last 9 years, that's only accelerated. Much of that conversation, however, remains simply conversation, Moreno says, as the military waits for the engineering side to catch up with the neuroscience side. Military officials, too, say that drones that can decide when and where to strike won't arrive for some time. I think we're years and years away, maybe decades away, from having confidence in an automated system that can make those types of decisions, says Lieutenant General Larry James of the Air Force's drone program. Regardless of anticipated timelines, the prospect of autonomous drones has many observers worried, particularly because these drones may mistake targets such as civilians. It's also difficult to say what will happen when multiple autonomous weapons get together. There may be unpredictable interactions between these autonomous systems, Asaro says, citing as a precedent the 2010 flash crash when an autonomous stock trading robots caused the Dow Jones to suddenly drop 1,000 points. So that's a pretty interesting story. I mean, in our lifetimes, we're probably going to see mass-produced body organs, as well as artificial intelligence, becoming heads of corporations. So an interesting look. Back on a more organic side, critics are faulting Alcoholics Anonymous for its lack of evidence. So this comes from NPR. Founded by two men in Akron, Ohio in 1935, Alcoholics Anonymous has since spread around the world as a leading community-based method of overcoming alcoholic dependence and abuse. Many people swear by the 12-step method, which has become the basis of programs to treat the abuse of drugs, gambling, eating disorders, and other compulsive behaviors. But not everyone is a fan. In a recent critique of AA, author Gabrielle Glasser writes in the April issue of The Atlantic that nowhere in the field of medicine is treatment less grounded in modern science. Glasser, whose 2013 book, Her Best Kept Secret, explores what she calls the epidemic of female drinking in the U.S., and says recent research on the brain suggests that the abstinence advocated by AA isn't the only solution, or even the best for many people. Cognitive therapy combined with a medication called naltrexone, Glasser says, can help ease cravings and has been shown in some studies to help some problem drinkers learn to drink moderately without having to quit. Glasser's magazine story has drawn fire from defenders of AA, including the Huffington Post writer Tommy Rosen, who calls himself a person in long-term recovery, 23 years, who overcame severe addiction and alcoholism in great part due to the 12 steps. Glasser's article, Rosen writes, is painfully one-sided. Therapist and psychology reporter Robbie Ludwig told Glasser and the host of MSNBC's program All In It with Chris Hayes last week that she thinks it's very dangerous to put out the idea that AA doesn't work. Does it work for everybody? No, of course not. There's not going to be one of those programs or treatments that works for everybody. In an interview with NPR's Audie Cornish for All Things Considered, though, Glasser discusses her story, the heat she's getting into, and why she believes people with a drinking problem should consider options beyond AA. So here's a few of those interview highlights from NPR. So on why Glasser thinks Alcoholics Anonymous should be challenged or updated, Glasser states, "We did a lot of things in 1935 that we don't do anymore. You know, when babies were delivered, we spanked them on the bottom and held them upside down, and that's something that didn't necessarily hurt babies, but we don't do that anymore. I'm not saying AA shouldn't exist, but what I am saying is that we can't prove its efficacy. And some of the studies that have been done just don't justify our immense reliance on a system that hasn't been found to be effective. In the modern history of disease, from AIDS to breast cancer, patients have demanded better treatment. They've demanded better drugs, they've demanded less disfiguring surgeries, and all these things have been updated. But because of our country's ambivalent history with alcohol and problem drinkers, our answer has been stick with the 12 steps, it works if you work it. And what I'm saying is it works for some people, but not for everybody, and we should be demanding more options." And again, that comes from Robbie Ludwig. More from that that interview. On the dominance of AA and the 12-step approach in the treatment of substance abuse in the United States, she states that there was a book that came out in 2013 called Inside Rehab by Ann Fletcher, and that book found that up to 80% of all rehabs rely on AA and the 12-step treatments as their foundation for their centers. And so it really has crowded out other different options. So it appears that this is something that if you do have a problem drinking, then you might already know that if you tried to go to AA. But basically, there is a lack of empirical evidence, you know, factual-based evidence that we can scientifically say that AA works. But as one of the skeptics already said earlier, the 23-year sober reporter, Tommy Rosen, rather, from the Huffington Post, if it worked for him, then I still don't see much fault with AA. You're listening to radio.dominican.edu. This is DJ Scrappy here on Worldwise. If you're just tuning in, we went over the science behind growing beards and if it portrays dominance, and then the difference between the robots that we see on the silver screen and the ones that are flying around today. And then we just went over AA and its lack of evidence. All right, so we'll be right back with more. We'll be talking about Ford Motor Company and their new algorithm that can detect speed limit signs, Antarctica's melting sea caps, and how to use climate finance to promote clean drinking water. That's all here on Worldwise. Thank you.
Tetons to the day that came before. Drifting is a simple thing to do. To dance across the treetops with reflections in a spoon. Black and white of color, a step towards the craters on the surface of the moon. Read on, read on, blue. In dreams he flies in a tiny raft in a broken sky. Read on, read on, blue. Saw the sun and a chance to be with the chosen one. Read on, read on, blue. Read on, blue. Swung through town in a piece of twine. Read on, read on, blue. Disappeared a thousand times. Read on, read on, blue. Read on, read on, blue. Read on, read on. Read on, read on,
Welcome back to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy, and we're here on radio.dominican.edu. So if you're just tuning in with us, we went over the science behind beards, real life robots versus Hollywood, and right now we're going to dive into the Ford Motor Company's new use of speed limiting sensors, or rather that they have sensors that can detect speed signs and slow your car down so as to avoid breaking the law, essentially. So the speed limiting tech can be activated via the steering wheel and briefly overridden by pressing firmly on the accelerator. The car company suggests that the facility will help drivers avoid fines and could reduce the number of accidents. However, one expert said the innovation might only serve as a stopgate. There's a plan for speed restrictions to be beamed to your car's computer systems and controlled from there, rather than requiring street sign visual recognition systems, says Paul Newton, an automotive industry analyst at the IHS consultancy. This would be part of an extension of the networks that will connect vehicles, allowing cars to warn those behind them if they are slowing down, which is all part of a move toward autonomous vehicles that drive themselves. Such a system, however, is some ways off. Ford's technology will become available to the public this August when it launches the second generation of its S-Max cars in Europe. A spokesman for the U.S. car company told the BBC that the facility would probably be extended to other models around the world. So the system, which is called the Intelligent Speed Limiter, combines two existing technologies already fitted to a lot of cars. Adjustable speed limiters, these use sensors mounted in a car's wheels to detect how fast it's going. Once software detects the vehicle is at a maximum preset speed, it limits the amount of fuel that reaches the engine rather than applying the brakes. The system does, however, allow the driver to quickly suspend the restriction by pressing the accelerator pedal to the floor, letting them overtake another vehicle or avoid collision. So I know a lot of truckers have this on there, and it's mandated by their companies to be more efficient. But then again, yeah, if you need to avoid an accident, and in some cases speeding will help you avoid an accident, it does need to be overridden. So the other facet of this technology is called traffic sign recognition. A forward-facing windscreen-mounted video camera that scans the environment for road signs and alerts the driver to the presence. Ford cars previously fitted with this tech are limited to showing corresponding graphics on their dashboard displays. And I know that not only Ford has this, Lexus does this as well. And I know their technology right now only goes so far as to, hey, if there's a deer or an immediate object in the way, then it flashes the brights on, and a lot of other car companies, if there's an object in the way, it'll just slam on the brakes immediately. So this is all just progression towards autonomous systems. Drivers will be able to set the new system to let them speed up to 5 miles per hour beyond the detected speed limit. While some motorists might still resist the idea of giving up control to their vehicle, Ford suggested others would appreciate the convenience and safeties that these offer. And again, probably within our lifetime, it'll be mandated for autonomous vehicles, because this is going to go directly into alleviating traffic congestion. Drivers are not always conscious of speeding, sometimes only becoming aware they were going too fast when they receive a fine in the mail or are pulled over by law enforcement, said Stephen Capps, a safety supervisor at Ford. Intelligent speed limiters can remove one of the stresses of driving, helping ensure customers remain within the legal speed limit. Ford noted that in 2013, more than 15,000 drivers in the United Kingdom had been issued with speeding fines consisting of 100 euros or more, and that a motorist in Finland had been fined 54,000 euros after being caught driving 14 miles over the speed limit, and it was a 50 mile per hour speed limit. I know, right? It hopes that the statistics such as this will help encourage consumers to spend extra money on the technology, which is not included as standard on the basic S-Max model. So other technologies that Ford is working on is aimed at helping drivers drive more safely. Cars from China's Volvo offer bicycle detection software that applies the brakes if a cyclist suddenly swerves in front of cars. So in countries like China or other European countries, pedestrians and cyclists are kind of a big deal. And it sounds pretty interesting. And it would be nice to have that here in America, but I still think we need to get more people on the cycling craze. Anyways, Germany's Mercedes-Benz promotes its steering assist system, which prevents its cars from driving too close to the vehicles in front of them and aims to stop drivers unintentionally drifting out of their road lanes. Japan's Honda uses a similar technology to provide its false start prevention function, which prevents a sudden lurch forward if it detects another object in close range and makes the accelerator pedal vibrate. Elsewhere, British computer chip maker Plessy is developing a car seat that monitors the driver's heartbeat, which could give the car control if it is suspected that the motorist is having a heart attack. And meanwhile, in Australia, Sea Machines has fitted an eye movement detection system to several coaches in Europe that sounds an alert if it detects drivers falling asleep. So heartbeat monitors, eye monitors. The advertisement that goes with it has a picture of a heartbeat monitor going on in your car. So it's pretty interesting to see how close technology is moving. Mr. Newton warns, though, that the rise of further intervention-based automotive technologies could pose risks of their own, a lot of those coming from a false alert. So removing the human element is one way of providing safety, but we know that computers can go wrong, says Newton. I suppose there will have to be a point in time when we accept that computer-generated accidents and even potentially potential fatalities are part of the parcel of the greater good. We'll never get faultless technology. So that's pretty interesting. Still a long way off from self-driving cars, though. Moving on, and you're listening to radio.dominican.edu, by the way, and this is Worldwise. Moving on, we're going to talk about Antarctica's icy doorstops, a.k.a. Their polar ice caps. So over the past two decades, the massive platforms of floating ice that dot the coast of Antarctica have been thinning and doing at an increasing rate, likely at least in part because of global warming. Scientists are worried about its implications for significant sea level rise. The ice shelves, some of which are larger than California and tens of hundreds of yards thick, are the linchpins of the Antarctic ice sheet system, holding back millions of cubic miles of ice contained in the glaciers that flow into them, just like doorstops. As the ice sheets thin, the massive rivers of ice behind them can surge forward into the sea. Antarctica holds enough ice, if it all melted, to raise sea levels more than 200 feet. That would take hundreds to thousands of years, of course, but the recent thinning of the ice shelves means that there has already been an increase in the rate of Antarctica's contribution to sea level rise, and it's accelerating. While it was known that many ice shelves were thinning and glaciers were flowing faster to the sea, this study is another in a series of really blockbuster studies that uses satellite data to show just how much and where Antarctica is changing, says Ted Skombos, a glaciologist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. And Skombos was not involved in this study, by the way. There's some very large changes that have added up, says the study's author, Helen Amanda Fricker, a glaciologist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California. The melting of ice shelves or the breaking off of icebergs aren't themselves signs of climate change. They're natural processes that help keep the mass of a glacier in balance. Snows that fall on the continent's interior adds up to the ice of the glacier. And while ice shelves melt and iceberg calving keep the glacier in balance by losing about the same amount of ice that is added, more and more it's been losing faster than it has been added to. And the problem comes when the ice shelves lose more mass. The ice shelves shouldn't be losing volume if they're in balance, says Fricker. This balance is what Fricker and her graduate student, Fernando Paolo, were looking at when they stitched together 18 years of satellite data from 1994 to 2012 from three overlapping European Space Agency missions that measured the volume of Antarctica's ice shelves with radar altimetry. Sorry, here on Worldwise, we get a lot of scientific words that are just tongue twisters. So, you know, forgive me for that one. Moving forward, though, what they did find was that the massive ice shelves were losing, on the whole, about 30 to 50 cubic miles of ice per year over that span. And in that period, the rate of ice loss accelerated by an average of 7 cubic miles per year. So there's a loss, but that loss is increasing, says Fernando, the lead author of the study, and that was detailed in the March 27 issue of the journal Science. The study, all three scientists said, show how crucial information on this kind of long timescale is for seeing the big picture of Antarctic ice melt. With a study that will only last for a few years, some of the ice shelves are not really responding in the way that they would over the long term, says Fricker. The story varies for specific glaciers, of course, in the different regions of Antarctica, with much more ice loss in West Antarctica than in East Antarctica, and for particular glaciers in the West. West Antarctica has been a major focus of South Polar climate research, in part because of the clear signs of melt there, as well as some spectacular ice shelf collapses in recent decades. As a whole, though, the half of the continent that has seen a 70% increase in the average rate of loss from ice shelves, the data has shown from these satellites, that the Odmundsen and Bergenshansen sea areas had particularly, and those were both two Antarctic explorers, I should say, who got these oceans named after him, but those areas had particularly high rates of loss, while the two regions account for less than 20% of West Antarctica's ice shelf area. They contributed more than 85% of the volume lost there over the period of this study. One particular glacier in the Odmundsen embayment lost 18% of its thickness over the 18 years of the study. For an ice shelf like that, all the others had been in place for hundreds of thousands of years. That's a huge loss, says Paolo. East Antarctica, meanwhile, has until recently been thought to be more stable, as its glaciers rest on land that is above sea level, and the waters surrounding it are thought to be cooler. Recent research has showed that there is still much to learn about the susceptibility of the glaciers in East Antarctica, which holds much more ice than the West. Talton Glacier was recently shown to have channels in the seabed beneath it that would make it much more vulnerable to an influx of warm water than previously thought, though such water hasn't yet been detected in the area. The satellite data in the new study showed that, for the first part of the study period, East Antarctica glaciers gained mass overall. Then that trend flatlined in the second half of the time period. At the level of individual glaciers, some have still been gaining mass, while others, like Taunton, have thinned. So I guess my question is, how many of these glaciers are gaining mass, and is that a rare occurrence now? Moving forward, the level of the leveling off of the East Antarctic ice shelf rates suggests that more attention needs to be paid to the eastern half of the continent, because if you turn your back on the ice shelves that are not changing, then you might miss something if suddenly you start to. Having this kind of long-term record of Antarctic ice shelf thinning is key to understanding what processes are behind the thinning and how they might continue into the future. In West Antarctica, it is thought that most of the thinning is caused by warm water, and that's eating away at the ice shelves from below, a consequence of changes in prevailing winds that is potentially linked to global warming. Paolo and Fricker said the data shows the characteristic signature of this kind of melt, which happens at what is called the grounding line, or the point where the glacier last touches land and the ice shelf begins. Other recent studies examining glaciers have also bolstered this idea, and have even suggested that some glaciers in West Antarctica have reached a point where their retreat and melt is now irreversible. So think of it as maybe like a pancake sliding off of a plate. If that pancake gets too far off the plate, I don't think you'll be able to scoop it back up without making a big mess. So the picture here is murky in the east, and in part because so much less work has been done there. This study shows, though, that East Antarctic shelves are actually subject to large changes. The biggest rates of ice loss seen in the Amundsen embayment, and I believe Amundsen, his first name was Rolf, and he was like the second guy to reach Antarctica. Anyways, back to the story. This embayment that's been named after him has seen critical loss, and if it continues at the same rates, could be gone within half a century. Of course, what's going to happen 100 years from now, we can't know, says Paolo, which is why it's so important to understand exactly what are the causes, the mechanisms, and what's behind the changes that we can see. For that, you need what Skambos calls boots on the ice, missions that put researchers and equipment onto the ice shelves to get more detailed information about the forces pushing them around. That's not an easy sell, because the Antarctic environment is perhaps one of the most difficult environments to work, says Paolo. But there are hopes that new satellite missions, along with remotely operated submarines and other technology, can help build our knowledge of the forces at play in the southernmost continent. As this study makes clear, Scambo says, we need continuous monitoring of this environment, because we're faced with a planet that is changing in ways we do not want it to. So, alarming news coming from the South Pole. And we'll just have to see what happens in the future. But I do have to agree with the author that boots on the ice does make more sense to get a better understanding of what's happening. You're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. It is Friday, March 27th. If you're just joining us, the first half of the show we went over beards and dominance. Do beards show dominance in men? Apparently, and that happens in larger populations, that I guess males need to individualize themselves more, I should say. And then we went on to robots in Hollywood and robots in real life. Particularly how drone technology has changed over the last 9 years. And then we went over Alcoholics Anonymous and its lack of empirical evidence. AA has critics, I guess everyone does. And then we went on to Ford's new speed sign sensing technology. And lastly, we just went over about climate change in the Antarctic. Moving forward, let's talk about Neanderthals. So what drove Neanderthals to extinction? Well, new studies show that it might have been us. Now, if you've read anything about Neanderthals, you'll know that all humans alive today have about, well, all non-Sub-Saharan African people today have about 6%, I believe it's 6% Neanderthal DNA. So a lot of studies thought that, you know, maybe Neanderthals just came into us. I don't know how to phrase this. But anyways, let's see what this new study says. Imagine that in a discussion with friends, the talk turns to invasive species and the cascading changes that they cause in the ecosystems they colonize. People begin calling out names and places. Pythons in the Everglades, cane toads in Australia, lionfish in a wide swath of the U.S. and Caribbean waters, kudzu everywhere in the U.S., or so it seems. If biological anthropologist Pat Shipman were part of the conversation, she might call out something different: modern humans. In her new book, The Invaders, out this month, Shipman declares our species to be the most invasive that has ever lived. She assembles a compelling case that the archaeological record around 40,000 to 35,000 years ago is best understood as reflecting a classic trophic cascade caused by the appearance of an apex predator, in this case, us. As part of that cascade, Shipman argues our ancestors pushed the other smart bipedal big brain primate alive at the time, Neanderthals, to extinction. The dates often suggested for the last of the Neanderthals generally is between 27,000 or 26,000 years ago are no longer reliable, Shipman says. She reports that a significant effort at redating a number of archaeological sites shows that no Neanderthal populations were left after 40,000 years ago. So that's that's over 10,000 years disparity. Although some Neanderthal genes do live on in us. The primary question then is, what caused this great population decline? Climate change, Shipman engages with this hypothesis, maybe, made much of it in the literature and finds it lacking, especially because it doesn't explain how Neanderthals were able to withstand the intense cold in previous eras. So she's ruled out climate change. In her view, though, Shipman doesn't discount the impact of climate entirely. What I suggest here, she writes, is that the synergy between climate change and the invasion of modern humans created an unattainable situation for Neanderthals. One of the author's favorite parts of this new book, The Invaders, draws on an extended analogy between modern humans entering the Eurasian ecosystem and the return of gray wolves to Yellowstone National Park in 1995. The wolves' predation of elk has led to more aspen and willow trees in the park, a good outcome for moose and smaller mammals and birds. The carcasses of wolves' prey benefited other predators. At the same time, most significantly, the Yellowstone wolves kill preferentially their closest competitor, the coyote. Coyote density fell by 90% in core areas and by around 50% overall in Yellowstone after the introduction of gray wolves. And herein lies the parallel, says Shipman. She laid out meticulous data that shows that when modern humans arrived in Eurasia, there was an ecosystem-wide crash involving many members of the predatory guild. Not only Neanderthals, but also other species, including cave hyenas, cave lions, leopards, and lesser scimitar cats. And since we don't see any of those alive today, especially not in Europe, I would agree. Going on, wolves are unaffected, a key point that we'll get back to. Shipman vividly describes what she calls mammoth megasites throughout Central Europe, in today's Poland, Ukraine, Russia, Germany, and the Czech Republic. The faunal assemblages of these sites, overwhelmingly attributed to modern humans rather than Neanderthals, are dominated by mammoth. Indeed, they feature staggering numbers of mammoth bones, circular buildings made of mammoth bones and probably covered with mammoth hides, dotting these regions. Here's evidence of an invasive species dominating its landscape, adapting in unprecedentedly sophisticated ways. Ancestral modern humans and Neanderthals' preferred foods overlapped significantly, but compared to modern humans, the Neanderthals suffered from a limited ability to keep warm, a high metabolic rate, in a vigorous lifestyle, such as handheld projectiles versus we had things like the atlatl and the bow, and loss of much of the wooded habitat in which they were more successful at hunting. Remember that Neanderthals are more of a woodland species, and we're more suited to grasslands. Shipman's scenario of how modern humans outcompeted the Neanderthals without committing acts of violence against them makes a lot of sense in an ecological context. One red flag did rear up for her, however. The book's subtitle, How Humans and Their Dogs Drove Neanderthals to Extinction, and its jacket copy primed the reader to look into pages for hard evidence that the domestication of the wolf played a prominent role in this process. Reading along, I figured Shipman would make this book's big finish, and she does begin to circle back to the fact that wolves are not negatively affected by humans in the predatory guild crash. Around 35,000 years ago, people appear to have successfully bred what she calls a wolf dog, the first, modern domesticated animal, from wild wolves in an early attempt at domestication. Through genetics, that tells us that these wolf dogs were not ancestral to modern dogs directly, though. Were these wolf dogs acting as hunting companions to our ancestors, well, giving them the special adaptive edge? Shipman thinks the answer could be yes, and makes a good argument for how wolf dogs may have increased hunting success, for example, by aiding people in retaining carcasses in the face of competition from other animals. At the end of chapter 13, and this book is about 15 chapters, the reader comes across this flat statement by Shipman. There are no well-dated Neanderthal sites younger than about 40,000 years ago. All are older. Unless future finds show wolf dogs in even earlier sites, Neanderthals were extinct by the time wolf dogs appeared. So this makes for a jarring note, and the discrepancy between it and the book's sensational subtitle. Plus, its cover that features animal-skinned dressed male hunters walking along with these wolf dogs is kind of ironic. So last weekend, the author wrote Shipman and asked her a question: what do you say to these critical readers who feel that, in the end, there's no hard evidence to support the suggestion that's so central to the book's subtitle, being that wolf dogs aided early human hunters? And Shipman answered, replied this way: I would say to the reader, number one, the subtitle was at the editor's insistence. I reluctantly agreed. Number two, we have sadly few good dates about the end of Neanderthals or the beginning of wolf dogs. The chances we have the last of one of the first of the other are very small. So I would not be in the least surprised if more work makes the two events coincide. In fact, the recognition of the dating problems and the recognition of these wolf dogs are both so very recent that I absolutely expect the two will converge. Expectations are not proof, however. And number three, hypothesizing that the two will converge makes sense of so many puzzles that I learn that I lean strongly in that direction. That the two events, the first known wolf dog and the last Neanderthal, are only a couple thousand years apart is, for paleoanthropology, with the hazards of dating, preservation, differences, decent excavation, etc., pretty dang close to what we could consider simultaneous. So please bear in mind, I am stating a hypothesis, and some of the evidence I would expect / hope to find to support it. So, an anthropologist stating their hypothesis. And that is a pretty convincing reply, and I'm sure my quibble about the book and its marketing decisions with the publisher could be reconciled, but not with Shipman's science writing. And while I'm at it, close editing could have been avoided, and I guess that situation, could have been switched up. But anyways, back to the book. The invasive biology hypothesis holds either way. Our ancestors caused the trophic cascades of changes around 40,000 years ago, and contributed to the dwindling of Neanderthals. Or as Shipman writes in the book, this perspective helpfully situates our ancestors as part of nature, and a vital part of the ecological community, not as an utterly separate creature that was exempt from ecological and biological rules. So interesting, and again, the wolf-dog connection is probably going to be made more clear later on, hopefully. I'm DJ Scrappy. This is Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu, coming to you every Friday between 11 and 12. Our next story involves the Large Hadron Collider. And this is a big story, so let me drink some water real quick. Okay, so. And this comes from one of my favorite science writers. His name is Don Lincoln, and he's a physics researcher and a really popular science writer. And he writes a lot of books and magazines and makes videos and does a lot of stuff to bring science to the general public. So he writes, "I'm a huge science enthusiast and an unabashed science fiction fan. There are tons of really cool stories out there that fire the imagination and even inspire young people to go into science. But I also know the difference between fiction and fact, and there is a clear distinction between the two. Fudging that boundary cheapens real science. If you're a science geek and internet denizen, just like me, you've encountered a lot of stories over the last few days with titles along the lines of Large Hadron Collider scientists poised to discover parallel universes." Now, when this was broken to me earlier this week, and this is me, DJ Scrappy, by the way, talking, I couldn't believe it. A particle accelerator is going to find parallel universes. Well, that's just wrong, and Don Lincoln says the same thing. He says it completely misrepresents an otherwise reasonable physics article published in the eminently reputable journal Physics Letters B. Absence of black holes at large hadron colliders due to gravity rainbows, written by Ahmed Farag Ali, Mir Faisal, and Mohammed M. Khalil, describes a speculative idea to explain why black holes haven't been observed at the LHC. But to understand their paper, you first have to understand why black holes at the LHC were a possibility. One of the biggest mysteries in modern physics is why gravity is so much weaker than other known fundamental forces. We're talking about electromagnetisms and strong and weak nuclear forces. While we have no real idea why this is true, one idea was proposed is that there exists more dimensions of space than the familiar three in which we live. If the other three forces are constrained to three dimensions, while gravity can spread into others, then maybe the weakness of gravity is an illusion. Maybe gravity is just as strong as the other forces, but appears to be weak just because it has more places to go. And I know that sounds a little odd, but Don Lincoln has a video up on the internet if you want to go check it out. reading on, "Now we know that this idea has issues because Newton's law of gravity tacitly presupposes three dimensions, and we are able to successfully launch probes to distant planets. Ordinarily, that would kill this whole idea, but there is a loophole. Suppose that these additional dimensions of space were just very small, say smaller than an atom. Then the astronomy argument wouldn't hold, and maybe the extra dimension idea is saved." So how would you demonstrate these extra dimensions? Well, the easiest way would be to study very small things. When you started studying things that were about the size of the extra dimensions, then you'd be entering the realm of where gravity is strong. And if gravity is strong, and you concentrate enough energy, you'll make a microscopic black hole. Thus, searching for microscopic black holes is a serious scientific proposition, because if we find them, well, then we've also found extra dimensions. Scientists looked for black holes in the extra data taken by the LHC scientists during the 2010-2012 running period, and surprisingly, or not surprisingly, none were found. From that observation, scientists were able to set limits on the maximum size of additional dimensions. The paper of Ali et al. Explores how one can retain bigger extra dimensions. What he's saying is, where bigger still means subatomic in size, given the non-observation of black holes. What they argued was that an effect was overlooked in which a deformation of space by quantum gravity would change the size of which black holes would form. If their idea is true, it might be that we have to look for objects smaller than the new dimensions to see the black holes. Now, This paper might be right or wrong. However, the connection with parallel universes is entirely misleading. People think of a parallel universe like the Doctor Who episode, Doomsday, in which the Doctor and his companion were marooned in separate but parallel universes. And that's just not true. Black holes are the signature of subatomic extra dimensions, not parallel ones. Plus, remember that these extra dimensions are ones from which electromagnetism and the strong and weak nuclear forces are excluded, so there's no possibility of making atoms further. Going on, since these extra dimensions must be smaller than a proton, that's another strike against the possibility of anything resembling ordinary matter in them. In short, the title of these articles is entirely misleading, and that's a shame because the idea of extra dimensions is already incredibly exciting. It would mean that we would have to rewrite our textbooks, but there is no reason to cheapen such a momentous discovery with sensationalist and incorrect science. These articles will eventually disappear, hopefully into oblivion. In the meantime, though, don't get caught up in the misleading hype. Instead, keep your eyes open. I mean, for real. Scientific measurements from the Large Hadron Collider, and you'll see some exciting stuff in the future. This is DJ Scrappy, you're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. We'll be back after a short break.
Come on, baby. Come on, baby.
Welcome back to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy here on radio.dominican.edu. So, we have less than 10 minutes left in our show, so I'm not going to recap with you. If you missed that much of our show, well, I'm sorry. But moving on, we have a new article about gene sequencing. So, the genetic code of an entire country has been effectively deduced, says researchers in Iceland. So you guessed it. The country that's been decoded, I would say, is Iceland. The team says they could now find every woman at high risk of breast cancer at the touch of a button, and it would be criminal not to use that information. I agree. The reports published in the journal Nature Genetics use the data to make a suite of discoveries, including the age of the last common ancestor of men. DNA is passed from one generation to the next. If you knew anything about the DNA of a child, or if you knew everything about it and their grandparents, you could figure out a lot about the DNA of their parents as well. The Decode Genetics team, that's Decode Genetics, has taken the whole genome sequence of 10,000 people and combined it with nationwide family trees. By using these tricks, we can predict with substantial accuracy the genome of the entire nation, says the chief executive of Decode, Dr. Carrie Stevenson, who told the BBC. By the way, this is a story from the BBC. Mutations in the BRCA genes led to a much higher lifetime risk of cancer and led the Hollywood actress Angelina Jolie to have her breasts and ovaries removed. Dr. Stevenson argued, "We could, in Iceland, at the push of a button, find all women who carry mutations in the BRCA2 gene. This risk could basically be nullified by preventive mastectomies and ovarectomies. It would be criminal not to take advantage of it, and I'm convinced that my fellow countrymen will begin to use this pretty soon. The data is all anonymous at the moment, and using such data in medicine would raise ethical issues, including identifying deadly disease genes in people who never volunteered their own DNA for study. Dr. Stevenson says there is a lot of debate still to come, but I am just an old-fashioned physician. My gut instinct is simply to go with these people and warn them, says Stevenson. He is already in discussions with the Icelandic healthcare system. The 100,000 genomes project in England and President Obama's Precision Medicine Initiative both aim to use such genetic information to revolutionize medicine. However, Mark Caulfield, the chief scientist at Genomics England, said the studies were very interesting and very elegant. He told the BBC the team in Iceland is to be congratulated as it has continued over many years to contribute to an understanding of the genetic information of disease by looking at the levels of the population. He said that the progress being made around the world showed we are at the cusp of the application of transformative genomic medicine at scale. However, he cautioned that there were many types of BRCA2 mutations, and it was important to be certain that they were relevant before informing women. The projects made a series of other discoveries, including a new gene linked to Alzheimer's disease. The team has calculated a new estimate for the last common ancestor of all men by looking at the rate of mutation in the male Y chromosome. They believe the last common ancestor was 239,000 years ago, down from a previous estimate of 308,000 years ago. They discovered that in Iceland, that 8% of the population is missing all copies of a gene. This could be harmful, beneficial, or have no impact at all. The Icelandic group is starting a study to assess the health of these people. Dr. Susan Wallace, who worked with the Nuffield Council of Bioethics on a report on the use of biomedical data, said it sounds like a very exciting study and could bring health benefits to the people. But the concerns are that the data is going to be made public and anonymity technically promises protection, but you can be re-identified in data sets. So flip side of the same coin. There are also concerns of commercial interests in the use of these databases, so there are a lot of concerns that need to be addressed. And what that all means is there needs to be a little bit more engagement. So I want my genome scanned. I want to know what's wrong with me, maybe. So that's all I have for you today here on Worldwise at radio.dominican.edu. I want to thank you again for another fantastic broadcast. And if you are available next Friday between 11 and 12, I'll be here, and hopefully you will too. That's it for DJ Scrappy, signing off.
Can you hear the green comet in not today version? Cause it raised I'm on to a higher place.
A cup of mate just to keep I warm, and a little bit of honey puts a smile on my face. Stars above will be shining bright, and all the pale moonlight coming down on you. Come the morning, feel the open ocean, set these wheels in motion, you've got work to do. I can feel it in the way, read it in the sign, catch it on the warmest breeze, and watch it come from above, and wait a little bit longer, what will be. I can feel it in the way, read it in the sign, catch it on the warmest breeze, and watch it come from above, and wait a little bit longer, what will be. In our two-day version. In our two-day version. Two-day version. So won't you play it again?
That was The Green with What Will Be Will Be. This is DJ Scrappy thanking you again for tuning in to Worldwise. If you missed any of today's broadcast, please go to radio.dominican.edu. Excuse me. Go to radio.dominican.edu to see student show podcast page and click on Worldwise. Alrighty. Thanks again. Adios. We'll be right back.